Érettségi vizsga angol nyelvből. Hallott szöveg értése emelt szint.
Welcome to the listening component of the Matura examination. The listening material and the instructions are recorded on this CD, and the tasks and instructions are printed in your test booklet. There will be three tasks, and every recording will be played twice. The tasks will begin with some music, and then you will hear, and you can also read, the instructions to the task. This will be followed by a silent period on the CD, in order to give you some time to look at the task in your test booklet before hearing the text. Then we will play the recording in one piece. After another short silent period, we will play the recording for the second time, but now in shorter sections and with breaks between the sections in order to give you enough time to write down your answers. Please note that the first item in each task, marked with a tick, is always an example. The whole test is exactly 30 minutes long. Good luck.
Listen. Listen.
Task 1. In this section, you will hear a museum guide describing a famous painting by Van Gogh called La Berceuse. Your task will be to decide whether the following statements are true, false, or we do not know because the text does not say, and write the appropriate letter in the boxes on the right. Write A if the statement is true, write B if the statement is false, and write C if the text does not say. First, you will have some time to look at the task, and then we will play the whole recording in one piece. Then, after a short pause, you will hear the recording again. But this time, we will play the text in shorter sections to give you enough time to write down your answers. Now look at the task in your booklet. Now listen to the recording.
Starry, starry night, paint your palette blue and gray. Look out on a summer's day with eyes that know the darkness in my soul.
This picture, La Berceuse, was done in 1889 after Van Gogh suffered the first in a series of illnesses and voluntarily entered a hospital in Arles, in the south of France. Van Gogh painted five versions of this famous canvas, representing Augustine Roulin, the wife of his close friend, the postman, Joseph Roulin. She was the first person to visit Van Gogh in hospital after his breakdown, and she continued to pose for him during his convalescence, when his head was wrapped in bandages and his neighbours treated him like a lunatic and petitioned to have him confined in a madhouse. In none of Van Gogh's paintings is the cycle of life theme expressed more beautifully than in this very powerful image of the maternal figure. Augustine is a key figure in the cycle of life. She gives birth and she nurtures life. Her large, full body suggests a kind of rock-solid peasant mentality which Van Gogh admired. And her rough, unmanicured hands are the hands of a woman who's worked close to the earth. Augustine is holding a rope in her hand to rock the unseen cradle in this picture. And hence the title, La Berceuse, meaning the one who rocks the cradle. In his portraits, Van Gogh often painted backgrounds which he believed expressed the character of his sitters. And the wallpaper design here, with its great swirling blossoms and staccato-like dots, is really an artistic metaphor for the energy and vitality of Augustine Rulin. When one remembers that Van Gogh himself was in a hospital alone, far away from his family in Holland, it is scarcely surprising that he repeated the soothing image of simple strength and motherhood four times. The version you see here is the one Augustine Rulin chose for herself, and, as Van Gogh remarked in a letter, she had a good eye and took the best.
You took your life as lovers often do, but I could have told you, Vincent, this world was never meant for one as beautiful as you.
Now listen to the recording again. Remember that this time we will play the recording in shorter sections.
Starry, starry night, paint your palette blue and gray. Look out on a summer's day with eyes that know the darkness in my soul.
This picture, La Berceuse, was done in 1889 after Van Gogh suffered the first in a series of illnesses and voluntarily entered a hospital in Arles, in the south of France. Van Gogh painted five versions of this famous canvas representing Augustine Rulin, the wife of his close friend, the postman, Joseph Rulin. She was the first person to visit Van Gogh in hospital after his breakdown, and she continued to pose for him during his convalescence, when his head was wrapped in bandages and his neighbours treated him like a lunatic and petitioned to have him confined in a madhouse. In none of Van Gogh's paintings is the cycle of life theme expressed more beautifully than in this very powerful image of the maternal figure. Augustine is a key figure in the cycle of life. She gives birth and she nurtures life. Her large, full body suggests a kind of rock-solid peasant mentality which Van Gogh admired. And her rough, unmanicured hands are the hands of a woman who's worked close to the earth. Augustine is holding a rope in her hand to rock the unseen cradle in this picture. And hence the title, La Berceuse, meaning the one who rocks the cradle. In his portraits, Van Gogh often painted backgrounds which he believed expressed the character of his sitters. And the wallpaper design here, with its great swirling blossoms and staccato-like dots, is really an artistic metaphor for the energy and vitality of Augustine Rulin. When one remembers that Van Gogh himself was in a hospital alone, far away from his family in Holland, it is scarcely surprising that he repeated the soothing image of simple strength and motherhood four times. The version you see here is the one Augustine Rulin chose for herself, and, as Van Gogh remarked in a letter, she had a good eye and took the best.
You took your life as lovers often do, but I could have told you, Vincent, this world was never meant for one as beautiful as you.
Listen. And that is the end of task one. Listen. Task two. In this section, you will hear some information about a building in Germany. Your task will be to complete the sentences with the exact words you hear in the text. Write one word in each gap, that is, two words in each item. First, you will have some time to look at the task, and then we will play the whole recording in one piece. Then, after a short pause, you will hear the recording again, but this time we will play the text in shorter sections to give you enough time to write down your answers. Now look at the task in your booklet. Now listen to the recording.
Germany's Secret Service has just got a lot less secret. On Monday, the weekly news magazine Focus reported that the classified building plans of the German intelligence agency headquarters had been stolen, including those for the technical and logistics center that a high-ranking official at the agency called the beating heart of the complex. According to the magazine, the plans included the exact function of every single room, the exact position of every emergency exit, and every security checkpoint. Analysts say it's a major embarrassment for the federal spy agency. Volkmar Seidel, an expert on corporate security, said, "It's possible that this information could fall into the hands of criminals or terrorists, and in this case, there is a real danger that the criminals could break in and commit crimes." But officials are downplaying the theft, saying that the blueprints were labeled confidential but were not top secret. The German public television station ARD reported that the theft had taken place from the supposedly secure construction site more than a year ago, and that the blueprints may have been taken on a USB stick. The decision to move the headquarters from Pullach, a small town near Munich, to Berlin was made in 2003 after the government reevaluated its security priorities in light of the attacks of 9/11/2001. The construction site is near Berlin's central train station. Using cameras or cell phones at the site is strictly forbidden, and signs inform passers-by that they are being filmed. Construction work for the 1.6 billion euro building began in 2006 and is set to be completed within 3 years. The newspaper Die Zeit had called it the most expensive and secret building in the country, though only the former remains a certainty at this point.
Now listen to the recording again. Remember that this time we will play the recording in shorter sections.
Germany's Secret Service has just got a lot less secret. On Monday, the weekly news magazine Focus reported that the classified building plans of the German intelligence agency headquarters had been stolen, including those for the technical and logistics center that a high-ranking official at the agency called the beating heart of the complex. According to the magazine, the plans included the exact function of every single room, the exact position of every emergency exit, and every security checkpoint. Analysts say it's a major embarrassment for the federal spy agency. Volkmar Seidel, an expert on corporate security, said, "It's possible that this information could fall into the hands of criminals or terrorists, and in this case, there is a real danger that the criminals could break in and commit crimes." But officials are downplaying the theft, saying that the blueprints were labeled confidential but were not top secret. The German public television station ARD reported that the theft had taken place from the supposedly secure construction site more than a year ago, and that the blueprints may have been taken on a USB stick. The decision to move the headquarters from Pullach, a small town near Munich, to Berlin was made in 2003 after the government reevaluated its security priorities in light of the attacks of 9/11/2001. The construction site is near Berlin's central train station. Using cameras or cell phones at the site is strictly forbidden, and signs inform passers-by that they are being filmed. Construction work for the 1.6 billion euro building began in 2006 and is set to be completed within 3 years. The newspaper Die Zeit had called it the most expensive and secret building in the country, though only the former remains a certainty at this point.
And that is the end of task two.
Listen.
Task three. In this section, you are going to hear an interview with John Williams, who composed the score for Star Wars. Your task will be to circle a letter or letters of the correct answer or answers in the boxes on the right. Please note that in this task, both answers may be correct. However, there is always at least one correct answer. This means you might have to circle one or two letters. First, you will have some time to look at the task, and then we will play the whole recording in one piece. Then, after a short pause, you will hear the recording again. But this time, we will play the text in shorter sections to give you enough time to write down your answers. Now look at the task in your booklet. Now listen to the recording.
Mr. Williams, how did you become involved in the Star Wars project?
My involvement with Star Wars began actually with Steven Spielberg, who was, in the 70s, and still is, a very close friend of George Lucas's. I had done two or three scores for Steven Spielberg before I met George Lucas, Jaws being the principal one of them. I think it was that George Lucas, when he was making Star Wars, asked his friend Steven Spielberg who should write the music. The best knowledge I have is that Steven recommended me to George Lucas as a composer for the film.
How did you feel when you were first contacted about this project? Was it about one film at the time, or all three?
I didn't realize that there would be a sequel, and then a sequel after that at the time. I imagine, though, George Lucas planned it that way. I was thinking of it as a singular opportunity and a singular assignment.
What was your reaction when you read the script?
I didn't read the script. I don't even remember if George Lucas offered me a script to read. I remember seeing the film and reacting to its atmospheres and energies and rhythms. That, for me, is always the best way to pick up a film, from the visual image itself, and without any preconceptions that might have been put there by the script.
When you first saw an assemblage of footage, what were you looking at and how did that inspire your work?
I think the film was finished when I first saw it, with the exception of some special effects shots that would have been missing. The first chore I really had was to spot the music of the film with George Lucas, which is to say, sitting with him, deciding where we would play the music and what its particular function would be for each scene.
How do you explain the Star Wars phenomenon as it occurred back in 1977?
Well, along with others involved with the film, I was surprised at what a great success it was. In my mind, I was thinking of it as kind of a Saturday afternoon movie for kids. The film surprised everyone in that they reached across cultural bounds and beyond language into some kind of mythic, shared, remembered past, from the deep past of our collective unconscious, if you like. The Darth Vader figure, for example, may be present in every culture, with different names, perhaps, but with a similar myth attached to it.
How would you describe the Star Wars music?
The music for the film is very non-futuristic. The films themselves showed us characters we hadn't seen before, and planets unimagined and so on. But the music was, this is actually George Lucas's conception, emotionally familiar. It was not the kind of music that might describe unknown lands, but the opposite of that. Music that would put us in touch with very familiar and remembered emotions, which for me as a musician translated into the 19th century opera, if you like, Wagner, and this sort of thing. These sorts of influences would put us in touch with remembered theatrical experiences. We were talking about cross-cultural mythology a moment ago. The music, at least, I think, is firmly rooted in Western cultural sensibilities.
Star Wars changed the shape of film music. A lot of filmmakers had really abandoned the idea of big, full orchestral scores.
Well, I don't know if it's fair to say that the Star Wars films brought back symphonic scores, per se. We've been using symphony orchestras since even before sound. I think if the use of symphony orchestras went out of fad in the 50s and 60s for some reason, it was just that. It was out of fad. Someone would have brought it back. It's too useful and too successful not to have it back. I think after the success of Star Wars, the orchestras enjoyed a very successful period because of that. Wonderful. All to the good.
Thank you very much for the interview.
My pleasure.
Now listen to the recording again. Remember that this time we will play the recording in shorter sections.
Mr. Williams, how did you become involved in the Star Wars project?
My involvement with Star Wars began actually with Steven Spielberg, who was, in the 70s, and still is, a very close friend of George Lucas's. I had done two or three scores for Steven Spielberg before I met George Lucas, Jaws being the principal one of them. I think it was that George Lucas, when he was making Star Wars, asked his friend Steven Spielberg who should write the music. The best knowledge I have is that Steven recommended me to George Lucas as a composer for the film.
How did you feel when you were first contacted about this project? Was it about one film at the time or all three?
I didn't realize that there would be a sequel and then a sequel after that at the time. I imagine, though, George Lucas planned it that way. I was thinking of it as a singular opportunity and a singular assignment.
What was your reaction when you read the script?
I didn't read the script. I don't even remember if George Lucas offered me a script to read. I remember seeing the film and reacting to its atmospheres and energies and rhythms. That, for me, is always the best way to pick up a film, from the visual image itself, and without any preconceptions that might have been put there by the script.
When you first saw an assemblage of footage, what were you looking at and how did that inspire your work?
I think the film was finished when I first saw it, with the exception of some special effects shots that would have been missing. The first chore I really had was to spot the music of the film with George Lucas, which is to say, sitting with him, deciding where we would play the music and what its particular function would be for each scene.
How do you explain the Star Wars phenomenon as it occurred back in 1977?
Well, along with others involved with the film, I was surprised at what a great success it was. In my mind, I was thinking of it as kind of a Saturday afternoon movie for kids. The film surprised everyone in that they reached across cultural bounds and beyond language into some kind of mythic, shared, remembered past, from the deep past of our collective unconscious, if you like. The Darth Vader figure, for example, may be present in every culture, with different names, perhaps, but with a similar myth attached to it.
How would you describe the Star Wars music?
The music for the film is very non-futuristic. The films themselves showed us characters we hadn't seen before and planets unimagined and so on. But the music was, this is actually George Lucas's conception, emotionally familiar. It was not the kind of music that might describe unknown lands, but the opposite of that. Music that would put us in touch with very familiar and remembered emotions, which for me as a musician translated into the 19th century opera, if you like, Wagner, and this sort of thing. These sorts of influences would put us in touch with remembered theatrical experiences. We were talking about cross-cultural mythology a moment ago. The music, at least, I think, is firmly rooted in Western cultural sensibilities.
Star Wars changed the shape of film music. A lot of filmmakers had really abandoned the idea of big, full orchestral scores.
Well, I don't know if it's fair to say that the Star Wars films brought back symphonic scores, per se. We've been using symphony orchestras since even before sound. I think if the use of symphony orchestras went out of fad in the 50s and 60s for some reason, it was just that. It was out of fad. Someone would have brought it back. It's too useful and too successful not to have it back. I think after the success of Star Wars, the orchestras enjoyed a very successful period because of that. Wonderful. All to the good.
Thank you very much for the interview.
My pleasure.
That is the end of Task 3.